the fan morning pictures on 590. JD, Blake, and Ailish. Happy hump day. Happy game two. Toronto Maple Leafs. Vic playing us in with the best music today, a little Fleetwood Mac. Let's bring in Jeff Merrick, host of the Jeff Merrick Show, co-host of 32 Thoughts, the podcast. Morning, Jeff. How are you this morning?
And your voice sounds great next to Stevie Nicks there, Ailish.
Yeah, you know, it's pretty much the same.
I always like, you know, when there's a... Like in this case, I know your voice is coming in. I'm like, I'm going to put her voice next to Stevie Nicks.
It's
like, what do you want to hear? I'm like, let's see. Maybe one of the greatest voices of all time, Stevie Nicks. Deal with that, Ailish.
She's my favorite. She's definitely
she's
my
awesome.
Favorite.
She's
yeah,
great.
Love her very much. We started the show talking about what our biggest point of curiosity was tonight, whether that's Leafs, whether that's Tampa. So for you, what are you looking forward to or curious about how this game goes tonight?
Well, a couple of things. So the other night, that was probably the best we're going to see of the Maple Leafs. That might be the best game that this entire team has played. That might be the best crowd that we've seen in I don't know how long. But as far as gameplay goes, that was the best we've seen out of this Maple Leafs team. Best we've seen out of a Maple Leafs team in a long, long time. It was also the worst we saw out of Tampa. Now, I know a lot of that was forced by Toronto, but still, I mean, I'm curious to see which Tampa team shows up and which Andrei Vasilevsky shows up and which Nikita Kucherov, who looked like he was trying to finesse and force passes all night long, which, you know, Nikita Kucherov shows up. Because right now I'm not going to say that Tampa's in trouble. Like, I think there are some teams that are in trouble. Like, I think Minnesota's in trouble right now, the way that they lost to the St. Louis Blues. But I'm not saying Tampa's in trouble unless that same Tampa team shows up. And then I think legit we can start talking about how many hockey games they've played in the last 2 years and fatigue and, you know, aging middle to bottom six, et cetera. So my curiosity lies more on the Tampa side of things, because I don't think that the Leafs are going to get the benefit of the same team they saw on Monday.
I said the same thing. I can't wait to see it. What does Tampa look like? Because they looked old, they looked slow, they looked discombobulated at times, they looked disinterested.
Off, JD, totally like, off.
Yeah,
totally
it just,
off.
It was weird. One is, some of it, though, I don't know how much is going to change, Jeff. Like, that fourth line was important for them this year, and guess what? They looked too slow to play in the series. And you certainly can't put them out there against the Matthews line, which happened in that game, and guess what? Puck went in the back of Tampa's net. Point looks not 100%, and I don't think he's getting any better. There's a lot of talk and buzz around his shoulder and what he's able to do with that shoulder, and I don't know if he's able to lift it over his head. Kucherov, I think, has historically been a bit of a front runner and a guy that you can easily frustrate despite the playoff success. I don't know. They have some real question marks to answer for. So I'm totally with you. I think that Tampa is fascinating. On the other side of it, though, if I'm looking at it from a Leaf standpoint, yeah, what happens when you get punched in the mouth if Tampa does punch you in the mouth, right? How do you respond to that? Who looks good? Mitch Marner looked better than he's ever looked in the playoffs in game one, ever. That's the best version of him that we've ever seen. And I was reminded of the conversation you guys had with him on 32 Thoughts watching him play, right? Where you guys brought it up with him, hey, Mitch, rumor is you pay way too much attention to the noise. And he addressed it with you guys, and you guys talked to him about it. And that, to me, looked like a guy who has blocked it out, who actually had the success of it. I wonder if you feel as though one game was enough to show you that, a brilliant regular season was enough to show you that Mitch Marner is a new man, or if he still remains the biggest question mark for you when it comes to the Leafs.
So I think it was either last week or the week before, the last time we were all together, we were talking about the history of the game and the history of star players that don't have playoff success. And if you look at the history of this league, like going back to when, you know, water froze and we dropped a little round rubber thing on it, the history of this league is skill players figure it out. Skill players adapt. Like, the one thing, like, there's maybe two things that I've learned about hockey since I started covering the sport in this industry. One, you can't lie to players. Players know who belongs and who doesn't belong. And two, skilled players figure it out. It may take a little bit longer. I mean, it certainly did with Pavel Datsyuk of the Detroit Red Wings, because let's not forget, the conversation around Datsyuk used to be, oh, he's a regular season giant, but that guy vanishes in the playoffs, which seems laughable now. The history of the league is skilled / elite players figure out the postseason. That's just how they're wired. Like, this is a challenge. It's a chess match. What can I do? I have this library of skills. You know, which book am I going to take off the shelf here? Is one game enough? No, but at least the one game opens the door to starting to have the conversation. And I'm with you. Like, that game by Marner, that was a Picasso.
Yeah.
It really was. Like, that was some of the most brilliant play. Like, that was confident Marner. That was creative Marner. I think I've mentioned to you before, his draft year, the Fort Lauderdale draft, one scout that I was talking to leading up to the draft said, look, here's the thing you have to remember about Mitch Marner. He doesn't make the right play. He makes the better play. He makes the play that when he's about to start making, you say, no, 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 that's the right. Oh, okay, I see. That's what you were. Oh, okay, maybe I'll just pipe down here and let you play. That's the Mitch Marner that we saw on Monday.
Yeah. You know what's funny is that early in the game, he made this play from his knees where he tried to get it back to the point. It was intercepted, and I went, oh, no, like, not this again. Like, he's trying to overthink the plays, and then the rest of it was brilliant. And that's one of my favorite things about hockey is we do all these numbers, and it's great, whatever. A lot of time, players can blend into one another because it's a lot of guys who can skate, similar size, and there's not a discerning skill set thing unless you're paying very, very close attention. And then you have these nights where it feels like a guy is everywhere and a guy stands out on every shift, and it's just special, and that was Marner in game one to me.
Yeah. You know, interesting about the blending in, too, because if you look at what the Maple Leafs now have with a combination of their middle/bottom bottom forward group, you know, it's roster construction is such an interesting thing, and there's such, you know, various philosophies on what to do. But it seems now that the feeling after, you know, bumping up against playoff failure year after year, and again, they still might. It's one game, but it looks like Kyle Dubas put value very much in things that are going to pay off now. And what's paying off is A, players that can skate, and we see this at the draft. Like, if a player can't skate, he is not, like, he is on the do not draft list. For the Maple Leafs, players that can skate and two-way forwards, players that are safe for the coach to put out there in any situation, whether it's Ilya Mikheyev, whether it's Alex Kerfoot, whether it's Engvall, whether it's Kampf, whether it's Colin Blackwell, as we saw on Monday, the returning Andre Kasha. The premium is not so much, we need to have rings in the room. We got to have guys that have done it before. We've got to have the graybeards. We got to have the veterans. Now it's just, we need to have guys that can move their feet and can play at both ends of the rink and can play in all three zones. And that's what you saw on display on Monday, specifically with the penalty kill, but also 5-on-5. Like, that's a team that, you know, they just outskated the Tampa Bay Lightning, defending two-time Stanley Cup champions. They skated them into the ground, and they frustrated players like Vasilevsky, Kucherov, you know, Stamkos, you mentioned Point as well, Victor Hedman. I mean, I don't think I've ever seen Victor Hedman that befuddled in a game before, and he's just, even though he probably won't win the Norris, he's, you know, probably the best defenseman in the NHL, with all due respect to Cale Makar. That was a command performance. Can they do it again is one of the questions we'll see today. What do you do with success? And to your point, what do you do when you get punched in the mouth? Because last year against the Habs, when the Maple Leafs got punched in the mouth up 3-1, what did they do? They froze.
They wilted.
And they froze for the rest of the series.
Yeah. And it's now stuff of legend of how that room went after the Galchenyuk turnover. That after that Galchenyuk turnover, that it just went south in the room immediately, and nobody could pull them out of it. And so, yeah, will they have a moment like that in this series? They're going to have a moment like that throughout the playoffs. Yeah, of course.
They will.
Of course they are.
Like, they'll have that, and you're right. It's not so much, okay, what just happened to us? It's, you know, can we park it? Like, the only elite level athlete in this conversation is Ailish, so she can talk about this. What do the best players do? They park it. They forget about it. They let go of it. They don't marry themselves to it. They don't continue to see its reflection in the mirror for the remainder of the game. They don't want to talk about it. It's gone. It's over. It's a moment. We move on. Let's see if the Maple Leafs can do that, because they will get, you know, they will get punched in the face.
Ailish, easier to do in a radio show or during sports? Like, park a bad radio show or to park...
I never have a bad radio show.
Yeah,
just
answer.
I only have bad hockey games.
But, Jeff, I'm glad you brought that up, though, about the way the Leafs look. And obviously, the skating is very, very clear. And that has been the model for them. But what I find a little ironic about this run for the Leafs is, okay, Marner was their best player, so he's a little smaller guy. They brought in Blackwell at the deadline, and Dubas is known for loving the undersized guys, right? Every draft that's, sorry, there's got to be a 5'8" to 5'9" guy who weighs 165 pounds that gets taken by this team. It's part of the, we must do this at the draft. They've done trades where it's been for Malgins or Patans. That's usually where they look for the inefficiency. But you look at this team and the depth that they have, Engvall, Mikheyev, Kampf, these long, big monsters who can skate and who can play defense. And I think that's a really good observation just about, yeah, their versatility, but also it's just kind of funny that they're winning with that. And this is something, I want two things from topics that you and I have talked about a lot in the past. And that is, the thing we hammered the Leafs about in different iterations was, well, how many different ways can they win? Because we know they could win a certain style of a hockey game. We knew they could win lots of hockey games because they had done that. But this version feels like, doesn't matter what the game script is, they can win. They can come back. They can defend leads. They can do everything. They can match styles of play. And in fact, they might have the better style of play no matter where the team wants to take it. And I wonder if that's what has you most confident in this group, or that things can be different, is that they are more versatile than what we've seen before and the value you put on that.
I think that's part of it, and I think they can cover a lot of ice really quickly. Like you mentioned, you know, the size, like you look at the wingspan of someone like Ilya Mikheyev, you look at, you know, the 6'5 Pierre Engvall and how quickly he can close, how quickly he can get to pucks, how quickly, you know, I'm always curious about, you know, the sphere of influence. It's more of a political term, you know, that we discuss, you know, with borders, for example. But I always think about that in hockey terms too. Like how much of the ice can you impact at any given moment? And some players can do it with, you know, elite level passing. Certainly, and others can do it with both size and quickness. And I look at Mikheyev and I look at Engvall, I even look at David Kampf as well. And there was an inefficiency there, like the Chicago realized what they had in David Kampf. You know, they have a lot of players that can influence a large area of the ice at the same time as everybody else. So I look at sort of sphere of influence, like, okay, Mikheyev's on the ice. Where can he be dangerous right now? Like, we know that there are some players, and you see this most profoundly on the penalty kill, right? Like, there are some players, you know, you look historically, like, we used to consider Matt Hendricks to be a great penalty killer. I'm going to sound like I'm harping on Matt Hendricks here, and I don't mean to, but I use him as an example. You know, what was his fear of influence was the puck right in front of him, he will block it because he was fearless. But then it didn't go anywhere. So his sphere of influence was pretty minimal. Whereas you look at someone like Ilya Mikheyev, when he's on the ice and the puck turns over, where is his sphere of influence? It grows. Like, how much of the ice all of a sudden is he a threat to use? A lot more than the traditional penalty killers that we're used to seeing, to the point now where we have the fancy term, and we saw this with the Canadian women specifically this year in Beijing, the power kill. And you saw that on Monday with the Maple Leafs, right? It was almost to the point where Tampa should start declining when they're going off on Minor. So I think you're bang on. I just want to add as well, how much ice do they influence when all these players are on the ice? Even, you know, someone like Joe Thornton, bless him, when he was with the Toronto Maple Leafs, still a sublime passer, but he wasn't really able to do it anymore because the reaction speed wasn't quick enough. So the amount of ice that he would influence has shrunk over the years. You know, these guys, you know, Blackwell, Nylander, Engvall, Mikheyev, they influence a lot of ice out there.
Seems like they're going to get a lot more opportunity with the way that the games have been called. Jeff, so I know that JD,
a lot of candy in the penalty box. A lot of candy in the penalty box.
Yeah, there's something special in there. I know that JD calls you the hockey hipster. Like, so we that, have to yeah. ask you, what's the
beard.
Hockey hipster's favorite team or favorite series to watch this postseason?
Going into it was going to be St. Louis, Minnesota, but now I don't know how
St. Louis might be really, really, really good, huh?
Don't know how. What's that?
St. Louis might be really, really, really good.
Like St. Louis is really balanced. That's the thing. Like If you want the hipster answer, is I don't think it's necessarily a team this time around. Although if you really want to hipster it up, go with that. You know, Iafallo, Dano, Trevor Moore. Yeah. Sorry, Toronto Maple Leafs fans, go with
that's
that.
Too
line,
ho- that's Los too Angeles popular teams. Now, though. After the 3-goal night, you liked them before they had a 3-goal night against Connor McDavid. Yeah, too mainstream now. That's yeah, all. That's hipster, like, not hip enough.
That line sold out against Edmonton.
Yeah,
man.
Yeah, they did. They did sell out. They sold out so hard.
Philip Deneau. Oh, you sell yeah. out. You know, the thing about St. Louis is they're just so they might be the most balanced for it. Like, I don't love their defense. I do love their goaltending, and specifically Ville Husso, but they may be the most balanced forward unit in the NHL. 920 goal scorers. And then Justin Falk had, 16? So they almost had 10. Like, it may be the most balanced, you know, top nine that we see in the National Hockey League. Two players had 30 in there, and Pavel Buchnevich and Vladimir Tarasenko as well. So I would probably go with maybe more of a hipster player, and I kind of been, you know, banging his drum all season long because he's really had a breakout season, most specifically from a playmaking point of view. And Ailish will love the York Simcoe Express reference here. Robert Thomas, man.
Nice.
Robert Thomas is very, very quietly put together an elite level season with the St. Louis Blues. I know the Blues don't get so much, you know, love north of the border, but man, Robert Thomas, this is the year we always talk about players popping and distinguishing themselves and taking that next step. Robert Thomas may be, I don't want to say most improved because the potential was always there, but I think you know what I'm going for. Like, he's in that conversation for that guy who distinguished himself as, you know, a future number one center. Might already be there for the St. Louis Blues. He had that good a season for the Blues.
Well, you know, I can always cheer for York Simcoe Express guys.
So
I'm on board with that one. I love that.
I dig that one.
Well, Jeff, thanks for joining us this morning. You can go your own way, as
You know, if I wasn't so tired right now because we did a podcast until 2:30 in the morning, me and Elliot, I'd have something clever to say on the way out. Other than, unfortunately, I got, thanks, Ailish. Thanks, JD. Have a good day. Enjoy game two.
We'll talk to you soon. Thanks, Jeff.
Thanks.
See you, buddy. Jeff Merrick. 32 Thoughts. Jeff Merrick Show. Good stuff from him today. I just quickly want to touch on what he said about the guys who can skate and the covering of the ice, because that to me was one of the most, Merrick put it best, right? And he does a very, very good job of being eloquent when it comes to those things. But that's exactly it. That's what you feel with watching Kampf on that penalty kill, right? Is you don't really feel like there's four skaters for the Leafs because he's so big and he's covering so much ground with his speed. And Engvall does that, and Mikheyev does that. Those three guys do that so exceptionally well. Obviously, Tavares and Matthews do it, but that's not what we think about with them as their primary function. But those three guys, like, we're about to talk about Masai Ujiri. Kyle Dubas needs to get rid of the whole 5'9", 5'6" guy thing that he was obsessed with in the past, and this needs to be the actual Kyle Dubas thing. And we need to give him credit for it, but also I actually think that this is going to be kind of a bit more of a model. Is you're going to get guys down the lineup, size matters. But it used to be size matters because you were going to be physical and you were going to be hit. No, size matters because you can cover so much ice. Wingspan. All of a sudden, wingspan is no longer just for the NBA. Welcome to the NHL caring about wingspan. Wingspan Twitter has now entered the sphere. I really think so. That really is one of the calling cards of this Maple Leafs team. It's an identity for them having those guys with that look.
We so often talk about spacing as strictly an offensive concept, right? And I know it's more of a basketball concept than other sports, but you see it in football a little bit where, you know, you want to spread the field horizontally and vertically to create space offensively. And the way to counter that defensively is have guys who cover a lot of range, right? And a lot of range effectively. We see it in basketball, obviously, where three-point shooting has changed the geometry of basketball. And the Raptors are basically betting, hey, the way to counteract that is, well, you can't have a sixth guy on the floor, so what if you just take up more space by having big guys everywhere? And I think that it's an interesting thing to look at for a penalty kill, especially that's been so effective and so dangerous the other way, is, look, penalty kill is at its core a spacing problem because you have to have four guys cover five, and what the Leafs are doing there, whether it's, you know, size, speed, versatility, length, it's hard to, and this is something that I would bet pretty strongly that whatever proprietary analytics stuff the Leafs look at, well, obviously it's way more robust than like expected goals that we can see, but I would bet that part of their thinking is, hey, the more space you could take up, the more sticks you can have in lanes, the quicker you can fill space. All of that stuff points in the right direction. And that's how you get a game where Jack Campbell has a 23 save shutout, where it doesn't feel like he has to work too hard to get that shutout, even though you spend half the first period on the penalty kill. I think it's a great point, JD.
Yeah, it really is. And with that, we've basically lost. We had to do hipster pick, so we lose Merrick Murphy, Random Wrestler of the Week. So with that, it's time for something to chew on, brought to you by Great Canadian Meats. And we have it be a little bit wrestling themed today.
Yeah, it is. And I want your and Ailish's opinion on it. I want the listeners to chew on this as well. And
yes, my expert wrestling opinion.
590, yeah, if you want to text into 590-590 and let me know your answer for this, I'll take a look at those as well. So it is time for something to chew on, brought to you by Great Canadian Meats. And okay, so this is hockey related, though, even though it's wrestling related. You guys remember the Danbury Trashers?
Of course.
Big time.
So the kid who was the GM of that team, AJ Galante, is now a manager in NXT, which is WWE's developmental system. So I'm
smart.
Last night, I've got a double commercial, like Sportsnet has five channels and they've all got great playoff hockey on, or the Jays game or basketball, what have you. And I've got a double commercial scenario. So I'm flicking a little bit and I come across NXT, and which again on the Sportsnet network, because we have all your WWE programming, and I see this guy and I'm like, why is this guy look familiar? Where do I know this guy from? And I Google it and it's AJ Galante. He is managing a guy whose character is like a Sopranos knockoff in NXT. So my something to chew on for you guys, which NHL general manager would make the best bad guy wrestling manager?
Oh,
because Dubas is probably the biggest wrestling fan among NHL GMs, I would imagine. But I don't think he's got that like heel manager in him, unless he's going to really lean into the. I know he hates the being lumped in as an analytics guy when he's a hockey guy or whatever. That's his only path to being a heel.
So Dubas, it's not Dubas.
No,
he's
no
a
way.
Heel.
He doesn't have a heel in him.
No, no. I would say that the leading candidates for me would be Ron Hextall, because he has his history of violence, right? You would have him be like a guy who shows up and hits people with sticks in the face. Like he just lumberjack chops people with his hockey stick. Number two would obviously be Lou Lamoriello, because Lou knows where the bodies are buried and he's terrifying. And Steve Yzerman.
How about,
like, I'm trying to.
Okay.
Well,
I have one too.
Okay, yeah.
Rob Blake.
Because he's big?
He's big. I think he's from Air, and we know guys from Air.
That's number two. That's number two. Come on, we need something better as a number two. Like, I think
he's a big guy. He can throw the body around.
Sure.
So,
but big guys
need,
but when you're a manager, you have to talk. Yeah. You have to be the one who builds the story.
Rob Blake would be the heavy. He'd be the guy in the group that's like just standing in the background intimidating people.
If the GMs were a group, if they were a group of guys where it was like, hey, this is a group, then you would need Rob Blake and you would need like Bill Guerin in there to be the intimidating members of the GM group. But if we're going off of pure one heel, one guy who could carry the mic, Lou to me, because he's got the threatening nature, Lou could come down and be like, and that's why there will be no media availability today. You know, like that would be his thing. You got to shave. You got to cut your hair, buddy. Yeah, like he would be telling people, like, you got to cut your hair. That'd be his whole gimmick. Like, there'd be some wrestler who has long hair. Yeah.
I love that, because the classic I'm a heel now move is like a guy who was cool, and when he turns bad guy, he gets all clean cut.
Yeah, so there you go. You'd bring him, exactly, and you'd bring him to the clean cut side, which Lou runs. He runs the group of clean cut players. Lou very high. Yzerman, because he'll stab you in your heart, like Martin. No, what?
He's a Philly. you know, he's got the Broad Street Bullies team that he's a part of. He went to Harvard, so he's smart. He can be articulate on the mic.
Not known enough. He's too underground, Ailish. He's too underground. We need a name. We need some pop. We need some sell. Nobody's getting up for Fletcher. Like, no one's getting out of their seats for Fletch. That's not
Everybody's
happening.
Everybody's texting in Brian Burke.
Well, he's not a GM. But, yeah, right. So I'm going
We'll accept that as a write-in, though, a former GM. Sure.
I'm thinking about just GMs. The reason why Yzerman, lastly, makes a decent one, because I went over the other two. Yzerman is, he stabbed St. Louis in the heart with the Olympics pick, and he's the cold-blooded cutthroat. And so, for me, it's like Yzerman's gimmick would be, you need to be at the top of the top, and if you're not at the top of the top, he cuts you from the crew, right? Like, he only keeps the very best. You lose a match, you're out of Yzerman's club. Yeah. He's cutting you right away. I should be a wrestling promoter, by the way. It's what I'm realizing right now, Blake. You would watch my show.
Yzerman's got a little bit of, like, the Ric Flair to him of, like, once you're a manager, it's like, well, I just won all the time. Why can't you do the same?
Exactly. Like, that's what that would be his thing. He's like, I'm a winner. I'm a champion. I'm known as one of the greatest winners. If you want to be associated with me, you have to become a great winner, too. Otherwise, it tarnishes my brand. Yzerman. So those are the three.
Yeah, I like those. And Burke's a good writing candidate as well. So that was something to chew on. I wonder what Merrick's answer would be.
Vegas GM, because he turns on everyone.
Ooh. Yeah, it's playing off the same thing as Yzerman.
The Flurry one, right? Kelly McCrimmon.
Yeah, the same thing, same gimmick. You're doing the same. Maybe they could co-run it together. They'd be like, we're doing this together. Let's take a break. Yesterday, Masai Ujiri spoke to the media, and it was the first time in a while where I questioned the Toronto Raptors' vision. That's next on the Fan Morning Show. JD Blake and Ailish, Sportsnet 590 The Fan.
Breaking down the top stories in hockey and Elliot Friedman every day. The Jeff Merrick Show. Subscribe and download the show on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.
No team has contacted me, and I see all the stuff that, like, you guys see. I dream like they dream. Yeah, I want Messi. I want Ronaldo. I want Kobe Bryant. Yeah, so they can keep dreaming. I dream too.
Fan Morning Show. Sportsnet 590 The Fan, JD Blake and Ailish. I need to mute my laptop. Blake needs to mute himself. Masai Ujiri spoke to the media yesterday. It's actually usually one of my favorite media conferences of the year. Masai always undercuts it with, I don't know why you guys, and he did it again yesterday. It's a classic Masai trick where he shows up and goes, I don't know why you guys make me do this right now. It's right after the season. I don't have any thoughts, blah, 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 blah. Do you guys think Masai Ujiri is not the type of person who's constantly thinking and constantly thinking of how he could tinker and improve and blah, 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 blah? Like, of course he's that guy.
He also is in control of when he does and doesn't speak. It's not like the Raptors media relations staff can go up to him and be like, Masai, you have to talk today.
Yeah.
He could say no. He could say, come back and ask me in a week. He could say, no, Bobby's got to do it. I'm not doing it. I'm the president. This is a GM availability. He knows what he's doing.
So he absolutely knows what he's doing. And in years past, though, what I love about Masai is, and I know this is going to sound like a weird thing to say, but he's very human in that he's relatable. People can hear him speak, and he sounds authentic. He sounds genuine. So much of sports speak now, especially from general managers and presidents, and when it comes from the very, very top, it's so polished and it's so neatly presented to you and packaged to you, and a PR team has gone over these statements, and it's the neither confirm nor deny approach to something more so than it is openness. And Masai, despite his I'm never going to say anything statements, it always actually flies in the face of the reality, which is we can usually take from his media conferences and go, well, here's four actually interesting things that he mentioned. I'm going to say that his media conference yesterday was about 30 minutes, and it was a slog. it was actually kind of impossible for me to watch because it was the first time that he spoke where I actually kind of felt as though I wasn't very engaged in it. And this is not a criticism of Masai Ujiri. I'll tell you this right now. Is the general manager's job is not, or sorry, the president's job is not to tell the media what the offseason plans are or anything like that. But he talks a lot about winning. That's a Masai staple, right? It's all about winning. It's all about winning. But there were a couple things that stuck out to me. One, he talked about winning in a variety of different ways. And that's fine because we all accept that that's a reality. But usually with Masai Ujiri, winning has never been about a draft pick developing, because guess what? The Raptors have done that before. He mentioned drafting Scotty Barnes. He said that last year in Tampa was a win because they got Scotty Barnes. And I went, that's a normal thing for any general manager to say or any president to say on any team, except for this one. Because I want to win in Toronto has never been, I want to win the draft in Toronto. I want to win by getting a draft pick in Toronto. And I'm not trying to make this more confusing than it seems to be, but the reason why I thought this was interesting is it sort of brought me back into the conversation of what is going to be the goal of this offseason. What are the Raptors going to try to accomplish? Scotty Barnes is clearly going to become the face of the franchise, and Pascal Siakam had an all-NBA caliber season that looked like it was about to tilt on its ear after Game 3, but ends up being okay in hindsight, even though you could still spin Game 3 however you want. I feel pretty good about Siakam. I think most rational fans would feel pretty good about Siakam's season where he's at. But the timeline question has always been, well, how do these things match up? Do the Raptors simply run it back? Is that the best course of business? And what I thought was interesting about yesterday was that winning became something that is defined in a variety of different ways for this organization, which it never has been before, right? Play in for what is the organizational credo. And they were basically play in for what this year? They got in the playoffs and we all knew that they weren't talented enough to win. So what is the pressure level this offseason? Because I kind of thought Masai skated through that media conference without having to really say anything.
Yeah, what I'm evaluating as a fan is, what are you giving us as concrete things? What he said was, hey, it was a year of growth, and this offseason, we just need everyone to keep growing. Pascal, Fred, OG, and he named basically the top eight, saying that he wants them all to improve, and he wants the core to be the core, and his goal is everybody improves. Well, duh. Like, obviously,
that is
that's
the ceiling.
That's great, but how much more are we expecting Fred to improve? You know, like, obviously we talked about it after the Raptors lost, that Scotty has room and Pascal can still grow, but that has a limit, right? Like, that's not going to change everything. And the difference from what I thought as a fan is, like, what's the timeline on this? Like, are you just going to keep saying that we're going to grow and grow and grow and, you know, the culture is great and we're developing our players? I just felt like there wasn't an answer to, okay, but when are we going to feel like we're not just developing anymore and developing and developing? So, like, that's kind of what I took away from it. And winning is great, but I want to know when and how we're going to get to actually winning.
But I don't think that they'll ever, that's not something they're ever going to address, right? He's not going to go out there and be like, then the goal is to win next year. The goal is to try. But I do think it's interesting what you said about the development, because the Raptors, to me, have already reached their ceiling in terms of development of two of their players, Fred and Pascal. I'm sorry, but expecting more of Siakam at this point is a little much, right? He's the league's best conditioned athlete who has turned himself into a walking bucket.
And he grew
one of the better
so
passing
much
forwards.
This season.
Yeah, I just, it's not realistic to me. OG still has room to grow, but again, there are other challenges there, and we also saw a season that had high expectations kind of materialize into a lot of pretty similar OG. Scotty Barnes has a lot of room to grow. It starts with a jump shot, but to expect him to all of a sudden be an all-NBA caliber player, which is what they need on this team to compete with this core, is a little bit too much. So, to me, this is kind of what I was thinking of, Blake, is before the Raptors won the championship, there was like this sense of urgency around the team. And part of that was the timeline of the players, right? DeMar and Kyle had been there a multitude of times. Now that urgency feels a little bit gone with the fan base and with the media here. And I don't think it exists within the Raptors organization, but it was interesting to hear when I'm getting back to him talking about the win being Scotty Barnes of, there were media conferences with Masai that had that level of his exasperation almost, right? Where he was desperate to win. I think Masai is always desperate to win. But that didn't feel that way. This still kind of feels like there's the glow of the championship that has sort of changed things into, well, we'll figure it out as we go, not, hey, figure this out. And he brought up how Siakam and Fred are still young, and that was Siakam's first time as, quote-unquote, the man of this organization, and that was a big step for him. And part of that is true, but also that Siakam's 28 years old. Like, him all of a sudden going into a 29-30 season, having all this, like, long runway, there is more urgency with this core, in my opinion, than it's kind of being presented by a lot of people as, well, they're young and they're inexperienced and they have a lot of time to develop this thing. Like, it's not a group of 24-year-olds.
Well, so where Masai probably has some trouble, and sorry, I shouldn't say he has trouble, but where this gets complicated on his end, beyond just if you were to trade away your 28-year-old stars, you're not going to get good value on it probably to marry those timelines. But you look at the core that existed before he went all in with the Kawhi move and all the moves that followed that. That summer of 2018 was their fifth go-round with that group. All of those players in that core at that time were older than the ones they have right now. So DeMar was a little older than Fred and Pascal. Kyle was way older than Fred and Pascal. Serge was older than Kyle and Pascal. JV was older than OG was. Siakam and Fred were the same age that Gary and Precious are. OG at that point was the same age as Scottie Barnes. So I think he probably looks at that and is like, okay, well, we're not quite as long in the tooth with this group heading into year three of this, because we can count last year as much as Masai doesn't want to count last year. I think if you intentionally take a step back, play in for what, with eyes on Scottie Barnes, you have to include that as that year as part of the reset. Yep. So next year would be year three. And so I could see him being like, well, look, this is the equivalent of 2017, 2018 with the DeMar, Kyle, JV, Serge core based on ages and development and stuff like that. Obviously, it's not the exact same situation. And obviously, you can't bank on a Kawhi Leonard becoming available again, but I do think that's probably what's informing it for him, is there's not a clear path adjustment to make. Like obviously in theory you could get younger players that fit around Precious, Scottie, Gary, OG, but you're not going to get good value, you're not going to get players as good as Pascal and Fred. So I think that's probably where he's stuck a little bit. In terms of the winning stuff, I think he's just throwing the Scottie Barnes thing in there to pump Scottie's tires, and because Masai is very much like, when you lose, don't lose the lesson kind of thing. And I think he's continually trying to spin that Tampa season as, hey, we took something from it.
But yes, having said that, we all identify Scottie as a clear and obvious win. Like, he's the
franchise. Well, I think that's just for him. I don't think it's for anyone else. I think it's, he doesn't like having one bad season mark on his record.
But you didn't think that was odd at all, considering that this is someone who has always been rumored to have been interested in building from the ground up. And I know that the philosophy has always been taken as, hey, the Raptors, they want to have a winning culture. I've still always believed that they could be both. Like, if we're talking about the timeline discussion, and this is what I wanted to bring up about the pressure of this offseason and the pressure of this market. I don't think that there's pressure this offseason from the market, because people are still in the glow of the championship. People are very pleased with Scottie Barnes' development. They're very pleased with Precious Achiuwa's development, that there are still a lot of young pieces that you can glom onto and hope on getting a lot better. But I really do think that comes a year from now. That there was a little bit of buzz about how Masai never mentioned Gary Trent Jr. once at the media conference, despite talking about everyone else. I didn't look through the entire transcript to double-check this. I probably should have. But that was a rumor. That was a little bit of a buzz. I think there's going to be a little bit of pressure with Gary Trent when that ends up becoming more of a discussion, that people realize he's on the end of his contract and that they're going to have to make an assessment. But a year from now, right, when Fred's deal is coming to turn and Siakam is one more year into the contract and he's getting closer to 30, I really do feel like there's going to be a weight of, well, what happens with the franchise? There's going to be a pivot moment that is nearing with your three, I don't want to say three oldest guys because Gary Trent doesn't really fit that, but with those three players in particular and how they relate to this core. And it's odd to me a little bit that right now the idea would just be, hey, run it back, internal improvement, that's fine, nothing really changes. Hey, have faith in the Raptors, hey, have faith in the core. When it could actually end up being a hard shift a year later. And I kind of feel like that's the way that this is going to go, is this year still glow of the championship, glow of Scottie Barnes, glow of rookie of the year, glow of low expectations, but that the following season it could end up being, hey, all of a sudden the pressure has turned up.
Well, that's exactly the point that I left with, was standing still to me and expecting there just to be natural growth in the offseason, to me, that's not a win for me. It feels like you're still stagnant. I wanted something more than just, hey, we're going to continue to grow. And it feels like punting to the next season. And I don't know if that's enough. Like, I know that you're saying that next season will be a big pivot. Well, I don't like the idea of just like waiting for that, right? As a fan, like, I want to hear some concrete decisions, or like, hey, we're looking for something to fill in here, or we really need this player to exceed expectations. It was just like a lot of, not complacency, but a lot of, hey, everyone will just grow and we'll be okay with that. I don't know. That just felt kind of bland as an answer.
I'm not disagreeing with what you and JD are saying, but I'm trying to put you in Masai's shoes. And so when you guys tee this up to me, I'm trying to come at it from his perspective. And what his perspective on this might be is,
I want your perspective on this, though, not his.
Right. Mm-hmm. So let me do the Masai side first, and then I'll do mine. And the Masai side is probably, well, you guys all said this all through the 5 years of the Kyle DeMar core, where I was constantly getting told treadmill, you can't stay good to get great and things like that. I think he's legitimately emboldened by how they won the championship and believing that being really good and being really good by way of player development and hitting on the draft and stuff like that is your best path to being great, because you're the closest to it and who knows what's going to happen. Here's where I see the gap between what Masai has said and what got asked yesterday and where this team is. So this is me now. What is the actual plan to get better? Like, timeline aside, what's the plan to get better other than we're so much better than everyone else at developing? Because there are 29 general managers who are going to conduct end of season press conferences and say, we expect all our guys to come back better and come back healthier and stuff like that. And the Raptors do have a better track record than most of helping guys reach those ceilings and helping them expand beyond what we thought their projections were. However, if that remains true, why has the depth been so shaky? Why is Nick Nurse doing his media availability the day before Masai and being like, well, we need better players 8 to 12. You got to get me a shooter. Fred VanVleet saying, well, maybe we need a center. There's a misalignment there in what you believe in and what the actual results have been the last little bit. And I don't mean the results haven't been good. They beat their win total by 11 or 12 over the Vegas projection. Precious and Scotty are two of the most improved in-season players in the entire league. So there's evidence of that, but I don't know that there's evidence that that takes you all the way. So what is the plan when Gary's contract comes up? If Fred's contract comes up and you can't get, Fred said the other day, when asked if they'll have conversations about an extension, he said, I love having conversations. That's a real question mark. So to put your eggs in the player development and talent identification basket is justified given their track record, but they don't have a first round pick. They don't have cap space. Yeah. They only have the mid-level. It's a really weak free agent class. It's hard to bet against Fred and Pascal and Chris Boucher getting better because of how much they've all improved in their NBA careers. But those guys are 28, 28, and 29. I don't know that you project a lot more forward for that. So had I been there, my question, I think, would have been, it's like, okay, all that makes sense, and the timeline stuff makes sense, and your belief in winning and Scotty, but how do you materially get better for next year? And if you don't get materially better for next year, then, where are you going if it's not moving forward year by year? Because that's something that at least the DeMar Kyle teams, until you hit the absolute stop point where they had to blow it up, was, well, you're getting better every year. You're doing this differently. You're improving. And maybe not the win record every single season, but, 2016, you have that breakthrough and go to the conference finals. 2018, you almost win 60 games. Like, there were improvements there. And it's too early for me in this. Like, this is year two of the kind of reset. I think I can have some patience with it. Yeah, I just don't count the... Well, we're going into year three. I mean...
Yeah.
I don't count the run-it-back year because that was the... That's a halo year. That's an afterglow year.
I count run it back in terms of they had run it back year. Was Siakam was the head of the snake, and Fred took on such a larger role with the team. And I know Gasol was still there, and Serge was still there, and those guys played important
and
roles.
Kyle.
But that really, Kyle was there as well. But that to me was still a season where when they went to the playoffs, their success was determined by Siakam, and he failed.
Even if that's the case, like, it's still okay. You're entering year four, and Masai might be sitting there thinking, "Well, I gave the last core 5 years, and then something became available." But look, They only have the mid-level. Masai basically said yesterday he's not trading any pieces of the core. He got asked, hey, when you talk about building with this thing, is it around the existing core? And his answer was correct. It's the first time I've ever heard Masai give a one-word answer to something. And so what is the path other than Scotty Barnes becomes great? Because Scotty Barnes is going to become great, but I don't know if he's going to become All-NBA great within the next 2 years. That's a ridiculous benchmark to put on a young player like that. So I think I'm a little more patient with this than maybe the two of you are. But I do think that we're getting to a point where we need to have a sense of what the plan. Like, there's not the cap space summer coming up. There's not the obvious trade target summer coming up. There's not a lottery pick summer coming up.
But this is my point here is, I think people have actually a ton of patience because, first of all, it's very uncomfortable now to do any type of questioning of Masai. We've seen this fan base essentially come to a point where they go, imagine, this is the take of anytime you question Masai, imagine not believing Masai or imagine questioning Masai. That's the take off everything, right? It's the easiest take in Toronto media. And to a degree, it's true because Masai has had success and he's brought a championship here, all of those different things. I think he really did foundationally change the Raptors. But you have to question Masai. You absolutely have to. That's the role of media. That's the role of fans. You need to be able to have expectations of another championship. The championship felt pretty damn good. And so to me, when I'm looking at this offseason, it's not just Gary Trent Jr. Fred VanVleet's entering the last year of his contract before a player option. Fred VanVleet is a four-year deal. It's a three-year deal with a player option. You think Fred is going to take that contract? You think he's going to opt into year four and that it's going to be, hey, no sweat, I'll buy you guys an extra year, don't even think about it. No, his whole brand is bet on yourself, and you just said it. He loves to negotiate. This is his whole brand. He's absolutely going to do that. You're not that far. You're not this super young core. So when you're looking at it through the lens of, well, this is year four or year three, however you want to put it, in terms of the development of this core, the difference was they had DeRozan under contract. They had Kyle Lowry under contract, and they were always paying Kyle Lowry more than the market was going to pay him, and by like a pretty significant amount too. There were really no questions about how you were going to keep the players that you had. With the Raptors, it really is, with the timelines of these two guys, everything was geared towards Kyle and Lowry. The vision was, or sorry, Kyle and DeMar, was win with these two guys and build around these two guys. The question about these Raptors that's so different is, are you trying to win around Siakam or are you trying to win around Barnes? And can you actually win around both? And I take Fred out of it because I think that we've seen that Fred is not a number two guy on a championship-winning team. And I listened to Charles Barkley the other day talk about how the Raptors are in no man land. And I said, I agree with that. They're in a good position in that they have a lot of good players. They have a good culture. They have a good coach. They have a lot of really positive things. But they are sort of in no man's land of they're not going to be able to tank and they're not going to be able to win. And this is supposed to be the thing that you avoid in basketball. And it kind of looks like they're embracing it to a certain degree. Scotty turned into Scotty because he is in a great situation to a degree, right? So I love the way the Raptors try to develop with winning. But it can come at a cost. And I think that what you're seeing is the cost of this potential offseason.
Yeah, and look, these are hard questions to answer because Masai doesn't have the appetite for a teardown. I know that that was the book on him when he came in, that was the original plan. But he doesn't have the appetite for it. He said as much. This front office isn't going to do that under Masai Ujiri. So they're going to stick with this, and they're going to believe that, hey, getting really good and building our guys was how we put ourselves in a position to make aggressive moves to win a championship in the past. And I think that he didn't say this, but I would assume that it's, you know, end of this coming year where he has those decisions in mind. But yes, that puts you in an awkward spot.
But which way will that be aggressive?
Yes, and it puts you in an awkward spot with Trent and VanVleet, where more so with Trent, where you, as much as they like him and people here like him and I like him, I still think you have to explore or at least listen to Trent trade opportunities this offseason because I don't know that you want to pay him $25, $26 million if he opts out. So let's take a break. Let's come back. And it turns out, Ailish, Michael Bunting has one of the same favorite all-time Toronto Maple Leafs as you and I. He's a big Darcy Tucker guy. We'll talk to you, Sportsnet's
Luke Fox. Probably for a different
Fox.
Reason than I was.
Yeah, we'll talk to Sportsnet's Luke Fox after the break about Bunting idolizing Darcy Tucker. And hey, is Michael Bunting back tonight? That's next on the Fan Morning Show, Sportsnet 590, The Fan.